and was too many, but four? It didn't work. No escape came. Those four Xanax proved no match for my racing thoughts. Sleep remained elusive. It was being held back by shame and fear and intense self-loathing. So, what's the next logical move? Well, for this drug addict, it was to take four more. This wasn't just eight too many. This was a death-defying amount. Somehow, these second four combined with the first four, and I finally managed to fall asleep. The sleep on Xanax isn't profound. The drug is notoriously shit at providing deep sleep, but I didn't care. I just wanted this brain of mine, this thing that stalked me, to quieten just for a few hours at least, and some relief from the incredibly painful detox I was going through. I was fortunate enough to wake up, but the Xanax had done something worse than preventing deep sleep. It had fried my brain and made me insane. I was seeing things, strange visions and colors I'd never seen before, colors I didn't even know existed. The gray automated drapes in my bedroom had turned into a deep purple color. It was as if the rods and cones in my retina were sending new unbidden messages through my optic nerve to my already barbecued brainstem. Regular blues were cerulean now. Reds were magentas, black was Vanta Black, or Black 3.0, the blackest of blacks. Not only that, but I had run out of Xanax, and if something was not done quickly about that, I could die. Remember, booze and Xanax are the only detoxes that can kill you. An opiate detox just makes you wish you were dead. But I was coming off all of them. My only option was to somehow get more Xanax. But the setup in my house didn't allow for that. I would surely get caught. So, I would have to come clean about the fact that I had been taking it so I could get properly detoxed from it, too. I left my bedroom and into a kaleidoscope of color of my living room. Is this heaven? I thought. Did the Xanax kill me last night and this is what heaven is like? I gently explained to my dad and the sober companion what I had done. They were both appropriately terrified. The sober companion leapt into action and called a doctor. I was completely out of my mind. It was then that I decided to share with my father a fear I was having. "Dad," I said, deadly serious, "I know this is going to sound crazy, but at any moment, a giant snake is going to come and take me away." My father's reaction? "Maddie, if a giant snake comes and takes you away, I will shit my pants." To this day, I was impressed by how my father rolled with my utter insanity. At this point, the sober companion returned to the room, expressed his disappointment, but said he was still willing to help me out. But I needed to see a doctor right away. We headed off to see him. At the end of the consultation, I apologized to the doctor, shook his hand, and promised it would never happen again. And I meant it. I was done. The doctor ordered new detox meds, anti-seizure medication. Detoxing from Xanax can cause seizures. We headed home. My long-suffering assistant, Moira, was called to pick up said medication, and we waited. And waited. For some reason, it took her hours to complete this new mission. The clock was ticking, though. If I didn't get this detox medication soon, some serious shit was going to go down. I could have a seizure. I could die. Neither option sounded good to me. Now three grown men were staring at the front door, waiting for it to open. And two of these men were also staring at a scared Maddie. After a while, I couldn't bear the scrutiny and removed myself to a small couch to the side of the kitchen. Reality, that acquired taste, was beginning to reassert itself, slowly, surely, like a lens focusing. And I felt absolutely horrible, both physically and emotionally. I was riddled with shame and guilt. I could not believe I had done this one more time. The men I was sponsoring had more sober time than I did. You can't give away what you don't have. And I had nothing. I hated myself. This was a new bottom. I didn't think you could get any lower than my previous bottom, but I had managed to do it. And all of this in front of my father, who was obviously terrified. The cunning, baffling, powerful nature of addiction had gotten me one more time. The front door still wasn't opening. This was serious trouble. I was a desperate man. The drugs were in full flow, the drinking too. Things were so bad I couldn't even cry. To cry might have signaled that there was at least a semblance of the normal somewhere about. But there was nothing natural about any of this. So, a bottom. The lowest point of my life. This is a classic moment for an addict. A moment after which one seeks lasting help. But hey, what's this now? As I sat there looking into the kitchen, I noticed a crinkle in the atmosphere. Perhaps someone not at their bottom might have waved it away as nothing, but to me it was so compelling that I couldn't look away. It resembled a kind of little wave in the air. I'd never seen anything like it before in my life. It was real, true, tangible, concrete. Is this what you see at the end? Was I dying? And then I frantically began to pray, with the desperation of a drowning man. The last time I prayed, right before I'd gotten friends, I'd managed only to strike a Faustian bargain with God, who had simply drawn a long breath and bided his damn time. Here I was, more than a decade later, chancing my praying arm once again. God, please help me, I whispered. Show me that you're here. God, please help me. As I prayed, the little wave in the air transformed into a small golden light. As I knelt, the light slowly began to get bigger and bigger until it was so big that it encompassed the entire room. It was like I was standing on the sun. I had stepped on the surface of the sun. What was happening? And why was I starting to feel better? And why was I not terrified? The light had engendered a feeling more perfect than the most perfect quantity of drugs I had ever taken. Feeling euphoric now, I did get scared and tried to shake it off, but there was no shaking this off. It was way bigger than me. My only choice was to surrender to it, which was not hard because it felt so good. The euphoria had begun at the top of my head and slowly seeped down throughout my entire body. I must have sat there for 5, 6, 7 minutes filled with it. My blood hadn't been replaced with warm honey. I was warm honey. And for the first time in my life, I was in the presence of love and acceptance and filled with an overwhelming feeling that everything was going to be okay. I knew now that my prayer had been answered. I was in the presence of God. Bill Wilson, who created AA, was saved by a lightning bolt through the window experience where he felt he was meeting God. This was mine. But feeling this good was terrifying. I was once asked if I'd ever been happy, and I almost bit that fucker's head off. At Promises once, during a rehab, I told my counselor that I was freaked out by how happy everyone recovering seemed. They're like a bunch of happy people living on a hill while I'm dying, I'd said, and he explained to me that a lot of those people weren't getting it and didn't understand what was going on and would eventually be back in rehab, and things would be even worse for them next time. After about 7 minutes, insert 7 minutes in heaven joke here, the light began to dim. The euphoria died down. God had done his work and was off helping someone else now. I started to cry. I mean, really started to cry. That shoulder-shaking kind of uncontrollable weeping. I wasn't crying because I felt sad. I was crying because for the first time in my life, I felt okay. I felt safe, taken care of. Decades of struggling with God and wrestling with life and sadness, all was being washed away, like a river of pain gone into oblivion. I had been in the presence of God. I was certain of it. And this time, I had prayed for the right thing. Help. Eventually, the weeping subsided, but everything was different now. I could see color differently. Angles were of a different magnitude. The walls were stronger, the ceiling higher. The trees tapping on the windows were more perfect than ever. Their roots connected via the soil to the planet and back into me. One great connection created by an ever-loving God. And beyond, a sky which had been theoretically infinite was now unknowably endless. I was connected to the universe in a way I'd never been before. Even the plants in my house, which I had never even noticed before, seemed in sharp focus, more lovely than it was possible to be, more perfect, more alive. I stayed sober for 2 years based solely on that moment. God had shown me a sliver of what life could be. He had saved me that day, and for all days, no matter what. He had turned me into a seeker, not only of sobriety and truth, but also of Him. He had opened a window and closed it as if to say, "Now go earn this." Nowadays, when a particular darkness hits me, I find myself wondering if it was just Xanax insanity, a continuation of the snake I had been sure was about to show up. The drug can cause what the National Institutes of Health described as reversible brief psychotic episodes. I later had a gigantic seizure in front of my father, too, which wasn't the most fun I've ever had, nor was being rushed to UCLA Medical Center, which at the time I thought was an angel way station. But quickly I returned to the truth of the golden light. When I'm sober, I can still see it. Remember what it did for me. Some might write it off as a near-death experience, but I was there, and it was God. And when I'm connected, God shows me that it was real. Little hints like when the sunlight hits the ocean and turns into that beautiful golden color. Or the reflection of the sunlight on the green leaves of a tree, or when I see the light return to somebody's eyes when they come out of the darkness into sobriety. And I feel it when I help someone get sober, the way it hits my heart when they say thank you, because they don't know yet that I should really be thanking them. A year later, I met a woman I'd stay with for 6 years. God is everywhere. You just have to clear your channel, or you'll miss it. Chapter 7: The Benefit of Friends. Monica went first. She placed her key on the empty counter. Chandler went next. Then Joey, big laugh as he really shouldn't have even had a key. Then Ross, then Rachel, and last of all, Phoebe. Now there were 6 keys on the countertop. And what do you say after that? We all stood in one line. Phoebe said, "I guess this is it." And Joey said, "Yeah." Then almost broke the fourth wall by looking out at the audience briefly before saying, "I guess so." But there was no fourth wall to break. There never had been, in fact. We had been in people's bedrooms and living rooms for a decade. In the end, we were an integral part of so many people's lives that what we'd missed was that there had never been a fourth wall to break in the first place. We'd just been 6 close friends in an apartment that was seemingly way too big, when in fact it was just the size of a TV set in a living room. And then it was time to leave the apartment one last time. Now, though, there were 8 of us, the 6 main characters, plus Monica and Chandler's twins in a stroller. Before that final episode, I'd taken Marta Kaufman to one side. "No one else will care about this except me," I said, "so may I please have the last line?" That's why, as we all troop out of the apartment, and Rachel has suggested one last coffee, and I got to bring the curtain down on Friends. Sure, Chandler said, and then, with perfect timing for the very last time, where? I love the look on Schwimmer's face as I deliver that line. It's the perfect mixture of affection and amusement, exactly what the show Friends had always given to the world. And with that, it was over. The truth was, we were all ready for Friends to be done. For a start, Jennifer Aniston had decided that she didn't want to do the show anymore. And as we all made decisions as a group, that meant we all had to stop. Jennifer wanted to do movies. I had been doing movies that whole time and had The Whole 10 Yards about to come out, which was sure to be a hit. Insert donkey's head now. But in any case, even though it had been the greatest job in the world, the stories of Monica, Chandler, Joey, Ross, Rachel, and Phoebe had all pretty much been played out by 2004. It was not lost on me that Chandler had grown up way faster than I had. As a result, mostly by Jenny's design, 10 was a shortened season. But all the characters were basically happy by this point, too, and no one wants to watch a bunch of happy people doing happy things. What's funny about that? It was January 23rd, 2004. The keys were on the counter. A guy looked a lot like Chandler Bing said, "Where?" Embryonic Journey by Jefferson Airplane played. The camera panned to the back of the apartment door. Then Ben, our first AD and a very close friend, shouted for the last time, "That's a wrap!" And tears sprang from almost everyone's eyes like so many geysers. We had made 237 episodes, including this last one, called appropriately enough, The Last One. Aniston was sobbing. After a while, I was amazed she had any water left in her entire body. Even Matt LeBlanc was crying. But I felt nothing. I couldn't tell if that was because of the opioid buprenorphine I was taking, or if I was just generally dead inside. Buprenorphine, for the record, is a detox med and an excellent one, and is designed to help you stay off other stronger opiates. It does not alter you in any way. But ironically, it's the hardest drug to come off in the entire world. Bup, or Suboxone, should never be used for more than 7 days. Fearing a nasty detox, I had been on it for 8 months. So, instead of sobbing, I took a slow walk around the stage with my then-girlfriend, also appropriately called Rachel, Stage 24 at Warner Brothers in Burbank, a stage that after the show ended would be renamed the Friends Stage. We said our various goodbyes, agreeing to see each other soon in that way that people do when they know it's not true, and then we headed out to my car. I sat in the lot for a moment and thought about the previous 10 years. I thought about LAX 2194 and the $22,500 and Craig Bierko. I thought about how I'd been the last one cast and the trip to Vegas where we could walk through the packed casino and no one knew who we were. I thought about all the gags and the double takes, the Murray brothers, and some of my most famous too-close-to-the-truth lines, like, "Hi, I'm Chandler. I make jokes when I'm uncomfortable." And until I was 25, I thought the only response to "I love you" was, "Oh, crap." And we swallow our feelings, even if it means we're unhappy forever. And could she be more out of my league? I thought about the summer between seasons 8 and 9, when I'd spent time in rehab, and People magazine had said on its cover that I was happy, healthy, and hot. Friends' funny guy talks about those dating rumors, the lead read, the final season, and his battle to get sober. "It was scary," he says. "I didn't want to die." I had indeed spent the summer getting sober and playing a lot of tennis. I thought about the first day of season 4, after the summer I had very publicly gone to rehab. At the first table read, obviously all eyes were on me. My pal, Kevin Bright, one of the show's executive producers, had opened the proceedings by saying, "Anyone want to talk about their summer vacations?" And I took the opportunity to break the ice, saying rather loudly and soberly, "Okay, I'll start," thus releasing all the tension in the room. Everyone erupted in laughter and applause for me for turning my life around and showing up looking good and ready to work.